The next case is 07-1129, UBS Financial Services versus Richard Levin, Tax Commissioner. Mr. Bernard.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'm Edward Bernard, and my co-counsel is Thomas Kenny. We are here on behalf of UBS, which acquired the former Payne Weber, which is a brokerage operation. The issue today is the dealer in intangible tax. It is a tax on the capital employed in the state, and I think the simplest way to look at it is a tax on the balance sheet, not on the income statement. It's like the net worth tax for franchise in that respect. So you take the balance sheet as required, you apportion it within and outside Ohio, and then you apply 8 mils times that amount to come up with your tax. The tax base is not at issue in this case. The only issue is the apportionment, determining what portion of the total capital of the entity is to be assigned to Ohio. The standard, the words, are very straightforward. It's the gross receipts in Ohio divided by the gross receipts everywhere. The specific words are gross receipts, and then it means the aggregate amount of all commissions charged, a gross number, obviously, plus 1% of the aggregate amount of all other receipts. So we're strictly staying at the receipts level. What we're asking you today is to apply the statute and to use gross receipts. What the tax commissioner is saying is use gross receipts for the commissions, but when you come to the outright sales, when you sell the stock or the other securities, then you substitute in net gains and losses instead of gross receipts. But there is nothing in the statute that would substitute net gains and losses, which is a totally different concept from the gross receipts. The tax commissioner knows that a reading of the statute of the words would not support the position. So we are told that there had been a longstanding interpretation, albeit unannounced by the tax department, that you're supposed to defer to, or that there were some definitions derived from accounting testimony under the current calculation of income under an income reporting scheme. But those do not supplant the statute in any way. And the tax commissioner in this case totally misapplied the language that we have. Again, the commissions are gross. There's no question the parties are in agreement on that. And the idea that there would be a different standard for one segment of the calculation, it is totally not determined by the statute, is not derived from the statute whatsoever. So we're talking about the outright sale of stock and other financial instruments. The best authority that the court can look to, and there isn't anything out there other than the language of the statute except for one thing, and this statute came in 1931. In 1941, the then Tax Commissioner Evatt put together a compilation of the laws, and the legislature said, we want you to do that, and we want you to comment, when appropriate, on what the statute says. This was 10 years after the enactment of the statute. And we've referenced that in our brief to you, and it states specifically that gross receipts from outright sales, which is exactly what we're talking about, shall be used. So that statement, near in time to the original enactment, strongly supports the position of UBS and completely undercuts the position of the tax department.
Counsel, could you, specifically the statute that we need to read carefully is what?
It's 5725.14, but it's the former section.
57.
It's not the current section, which was changed in 2003.
14, in effect, on what date?
Well, the tax years that we're talking about are 1999, 2000, and 2001. So you could look at it as being the beginning of the year in each case.
And when is the dispute about what's in the numerator and what's in the denominator?
Although you have to be consistent. So it has to be the same for both the numerator and the denominator.
But and that's what the dispute is about.
Yes. I mean, so it's how you calculate it,
right?
And how you define it, and then the calculation.
The argument comes down to which, the denominator or the numerator?
Well, I don't think it's either, because it would, wherever it goes, it goes. So what we're talking about is defining what goes in both the numerator and the denominator. So we would say that the gross receipts is used in the numerator to assign it to Ohio, and in the everywhere calculation that assigns it throughout the United States. So it's on both sides. When you do this, when you include not the net gains and losses, but the gross receipts from the outright sales, it dilutes the factor in the sense that less of it gets assigned to Ohio. And the reason for that is that UBS was based in New Jersey. So when they were making outright sales, they were making them more often from the New Jersey office, which is something the General Assembly understood what was going on. And so it affects both parts, but it has the effect of reducing the portion of the capital that's assigned to Ohio.
And the importance of that is presumably that the tax rate in New Jersey is lower than it is in Ohio?
Actually, I don't know that it would be, but it's on a different basis. Because we have this property tax that's a intangible property tax, and New Jersey would have, I believe, an income tax. So it's pretty hard to say which is better and which is worse. But I mean, we're dealing with the Ohio statute and how it assigns it, and then let the taxes go where they were, where they will. And I think that's what the General Assembly provided.
So let me come back again to the math. You're saying that you and your client and the tax commissioner disagree as to the number that goes both in the numerator and the denominator.
That's right. And it really gets down to how you define the base. And what do you mean by gross receipts? I don't know that we would dispute the number once we know that it's gross receipts, but it's that definition. And they're substituting, instead of gross receipts, a net gains and losses, which is a completely different concept.
That's a smaller number, right?
That would be a smaller number contributed by the outright sales, correct? Because let me take an example, Your Honor. So if we bought the stock for 100 and we sold it for 101, then we would say the gross receipts from that is 101. They would say the gross receipts from that sale at 101 was $1, which is an income number, but it is certainly not a gross receipts number. So very clearly, just on the basis of the statute, it's the 101, not the 100. On the commissions, if we get $3 commission on a sale of somebody else's stock, it's $3. You don't reduce that in any way. We agree with them on that. But it's this 101 versus 100 that we're really talking about.
But that goes, which is that, the numerator or the denominator?
Absolutely both of them. To work properly, it has to go top and bottom. It has to go within Ohio and everywhere in order to make the statute work properly.
So the numbers are grossly different, both above and below the line.
I'm sorry, when you say grossly different, I mean, there's a suggestion of distortion.
Yeah,
there isn't.
Well, you're in your example, it's 100 times the difference.
It is 100 times the difference, but the statute says that you use gross receipts, but there is a difference between sales of the securities. It takes $1 of commissions to equal $100 of sales. So in the example that we had where we sold it for 101, only $1 and change would be included with respect to the sale, but on the commission at $3, the entire $3 is involved. And it's that mechanism that says, we understand that when you sell the entire security, that's going to tend to expand the calculation. And so the General Assembly specifically provided this 100-to-1 ratio. So yes, you get a lot more from the sale of the outright sales, but the General Assembly said, yeah, but you only take 1% of those. And then you get less on the commissions, but the General Assembly said you take them all. So the problem that's being presented to you as a distortion is actually something that was specifically addressed by the legislature in 1931, and there's no reason to change that. As to the administrative, longstanding administrative interpretation, you wouldn't be hearing that argument if the statute supported the tax commissioner's position. But more than that, there wasn't such a longstanding administrative interpretation. There was nothing announced. There was no rule, no information release. There was absolutely nothing.
Well, Counselor, your client is certainly not the only corporation involved in this activity, this taxable activity in the state of Ohio.
Yes, sir. And
you have a pretty expansive tax practice. Are they applying the same approach to others? And what's been the history up to this point? Is your position going to represent a change in terms of the revenue, or is their position going to represent a change in terms of the revenue stream?
Actually, it's not going to have any effect on revenue. It can't. And the reason is twofold. And I won't get back to the question about what other people are doing, but this doesn't have any impact because in 2003, they changed the statute in a completely different direction and threw out the outright sales altogether and used only the commissions. Also, there's a two-year statute of limitations, so this can't have a revenue impact. But getting back to the point what everybody is doing, we don't know what everybody is doing. We assume they followed the statute. We made a mistake. We should have followed the statute. We did something else. But I assume they did it right, and I can tell you I know of no reason to believe that others were not doing it right. Now, what you've been told by argument is, well, the tax commissioner would have known. But what the testimony was is that the agent didn't audit these returns, and so he assumed everybody did it the way he thinks it ought to be done, that is the agent, but he admitted he hadn't done the audits. So I assume that we were different than other people and that other people followed the statute and used gross receipts, not net gains and losses. And I, from my practice, I know no reason to think anything else.
Do you wish to speak to the jurisdictional issue, or are you going to leave that to Mr. Hubbard?
I don't want to, no, Your Honor. I'd like to address it. Thank you. The question is that under this particular statutory scheme, you are required to preserve your issues before there's a final determination by the tax commissioner. And what that means is, and you've got to do it in writing, you have to present to either the tax agent or the attorneys in the tax appeals division your issue. We told them that we miscalculated this tax. And the agent, or actually the attorneys in the tax department said, we'll take that under consideration, but you're wrong, we don't agree with you. When it went up to the court, to the Board of Tax Appeals, then the tax commissioner for the first time said, well, you should have done something different. And near as I can tell, there's two things we should have done according to them. One, we should have filed an application for refund. The problem with that, there is no such thing in the property tax. There isn't anything called an application for refund. The second thing we were supposed to have done is to file an amended return. But the issue with an amended return is you file the amended return if the tax commissioner hasn't come in to look at you and you need to get an issue before him. But if the agent's already in there, there is nothing in the statute and nothing in the practice that would require you to file an amended return. What you do is you get your information, you present it to the tax agent, you present it to the attorneys, and they deal with it. That's what we did in this case. And so, and there was quite a bit of law that is presented under the property tax where the tax commissioner cannot crystallize the errors, and that's what he's asking for in this case. I'd like to reserve, if I have any more time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bernard. Mr. Hubbard.
May it please the court, we ask that this court affirm as reasonable and lawful the Board of Tax Appeals decision, which affirmed the commissioner's application of the plain meaning of the statute. This is not a situation that my colleague claims it is, that we're relying on an administrative interpretation because the statute itself doesn't provide what we say it does. Quite the contrary. The Board of Tax Appeals in this case expressly applied the statutory language at issue and found that the term receipts means the revenues. And revenues are the gains from the sale of the security. That didn't come from thin air. That came from our expert accounting witness. I didn't hear Mr. Bernard even mention that. But if we look at the Board of Tax Appeals decision, it was predicated on a plain meaning of the statute analysis and buttressed by the administrative, longstanding administrative interpretation, which we know is at least 50 years in the making. And we know that because the current, the administrator at that time of that tax, the longtime supervisor, testified specifically to what everybody in the industry did for as long as he was there, which was 30 years. And he also testified that his mentor was the prior supervisor administrator of that tax. And the Chief Justice may have been in the tax section at some point during that and may have had a case. But Mike Sachs, administrator, I hate to point.
Would he have to recuse then? Or
yeah,
is that what you're saying?
My memory is totally faded.
I don't blame you. I can't remember that stuff
never
either.
Counsel, what are you saying about the? You're saying that there was evidence presented to the BTA,
yes,
through testimony, that with respect to all other similarly situated taxpayers,
all the dealers in tangibles who are brokers, right?
Right. That the numerator and the denominator of this equation involve the net gain, the profits or losses,
right?
Instead of the
gross
receipts from the transaction.
Well, again, the receipts in this industry, in the financial industry generally, receipts are the revenues, are the gains. When you're selling a capital asset, you have the cost of the security you purchased, and then you sell it. And the earnings from that are the revenues. Those are the receipts. And we know that from
In an income tax sense, but we're not dealing with the income tax here.
Your Honor, it's not income tax. It's for all financial statement representation under the generally accepted accounting principles. When they're filing their balance sheets, they're governed by generally accepted accounting principles. And the highest authority of generally accepted accounting principles is the FASB standards, the Financial Accounting Standards Board standards. We attach to our brief Financial Accounting Standards Board number 95. Our expert witness, Dr. Ray Stevens, the chair of the accounting department at OU, and used to be at OSU. He's the director of the MBA school there. He's a former SEC official. Very well regarded. Mr. Burnett used him against me in a few cases. I think that he is a very good authority on what constitutes financial state, what this term meant. And receipts is a term of art used for financial statement purposes with respect to the sale of securities on the security broker's own account as principal. That's what we're talking about with respect to the issue here. With respect to that, receipts means the aggregate gains or losses, all of them netted together. That's what the receipts are. That's what the industry has always used. In fact, this particular taxpayer, we have the returns going back from 1995. The first year at issue here is 1999. We didn't have any returns prior to that. They always complied with it that way. That's the way they reported. That's the way they reported for the 1999, 2000, and 2001 tax years at issue here. It was only when we caught them understating their commissions in Ohio by 40%. They took a 40% haircut. And so we assessed all the way up to 100%. That's what the $700,000 of additional tax we assessed comprises, that 40% additional amount. We caught them on audit. Then they said, aha, we were wrong all these years. We were totally wrong. We should have diluted the denominator. We should have inflated the denominator of that fraction by trillions of dollars of sales from these market transactions, and you take 1% of that, so it's billions.
Trillions?
Actually, trillions. What they're doing, these transactions, Justice Cupp, they're a market maker on the NASDAQ exchange. The New York Stock Exchange and the American Exchange have their own market. They make their own market. But with respect to the NASDAQ, the various brokerage companies do. They have a market basket of like 30 stocks each. You know, big Intel, for example, or Amgen, or there's other stocks that are traded on the NASDAQ rather than the New York. And they have a market of those. They mean inventories. And it's the difference between the bid and the ask price. They get a portion of that. So they're buying it from someone and then selling it right back for a little bit more.
Mr. Hubbard, could you go back to the example that Mr. Burnett used regarding the $101 sale of $100 stock, and also talk about commissions, because that's where I want to make sure I understand your position.
Thank you, Justice Lanziger. Actually, if I may modify it a little bit to correct it to the facts of this case as demonstrated. Dr. Stevens did an inventory turnover analysis, and he also did an analysis of their total revenues or total income, total gains and losses from the sales of these principal securities, and then looked to see what that was relative to the total sales prices, okay? And you know what that came out to? 1/20th of 1%. So they're getting the difference between the bid and the ask price, a portion of that. So it's not $101 that they bought it for, or they got for the stock and they purchased for 100. Mm-hmm. They purchased for $100 and got $100.20. I think that's right. 1/20th of 1%. Yeah. So no, for 5 cents. Sorry. So it's $100 and they get 5 cents. So they sell it for $100.05. They want to include the $100.05 in the denominator. None of it's going to be included in the numerator. Whereas what we're saying is that if you take that full $105 in, or $100.05 in the denominator, when it only generated 5 cents, you're going to totally distort the income, or I'm sorry, the business activity measurement. What we're trying to do is fairly measure Ohio business activity relative to business activity everywhere. If we accept what they're doing is correct, and nobody did that in the whole history of the tax, if we accept that, their sole business tax liability is going to be reduced from, for 1 year, it was like $600,000 1999 year, reduce it down to $20,000. And similarly, it's going to reduce it by a factor of tenfold. That's the sole business tax they pay in Ohio. They don't pay the business personal property tax. They don't pay the corporate franchise tax. They don't pay the recently enacted commercial activities tax. This is the sole tax they pay. And it would fundamentally distort their business activity in Ohio. And that's the pole star of any apportionment statute, that you want to fairly measure the business activity in Ohio. But we have the plain meaning of the statute as established by expert accounting testimony and also the FASB standards, which define what constitutes for financial statement purposes what receipts are. That's what we relied on. That's what the board heavily relied on. We also have that this practice, this application of the plain meaning of the statute, was applied for year after year after year after year in every case. And we know that we don't have to do an audit of every return. And he mischaracterized what the statement was. The statement was the agent and the supervisor of the tax said everybody complied with that. That's how they were instructed to comply with it. He was the one who talked to the people in the industry. And we're talking about between 20 and 50 firms that are engaged in securities business in Ohio. It's not a mass universe of taxpayers. It's a very cozy relationship in that sense that people communicate frequently on this, including UBS, who complied with this law for every known period we know until they were caught on audit. So, but that, the testimony of the agent, the supervisor, the administrator of this particular tax, was that if you looked at the return and you looked at what they were claiming to be the case, the denominator would easily flag what they were doing. These market-making transactions are in the trillions of dollars, so in the denominator, when you multiply it by 1%, you have billions, much more billions than that could otherwise be generated if they were not taking this position that they're claiming now. I mean, so there was a red flag. And so the agent was testifying very knowledgeably. If you saw the denominator was that huge, it would reduce the Ohio fraction to zero almost. In this case, their fraction in Ohio is 0.02% of their total activity everywhere. I mean, it's 3% if you look at the commissions. And Justice Pfeiffer, after the 2002 tax year, affected for the 2003 tax year, the legislature just used commissions. So now they're paying it between 2 and 3%, like they were for all the earlier years. And there's other income too here, other the company. Brokerage companies are engaged in activities that generate revenues or income other than the sale of securities on their own account and other through commissions. They do management fees, they do all sorts of other work for which they generate income. Under their approach, that other income would have almost no influence whatsoever. Either. In other words, the thing that would trump everything, would just totally dwarf all their comparisons, would be this market-making activity that they do automatically by a computer program as they're maintaining on this New York Stock Exchange. Or not the New York, the NASDAQ, not the New York. So I guess what I would say is not in almost every respect that he's represented, if you just look at the Board of Tax Appeals decision and you look at the record, you'll see that he's incorrect. The plain meaning of the statute, based upon the meaning of receipts, is what we say it is. Number one. Number two, the long-standing administrative practice, which they themselves complied with for the tax years at issue and for at least from prior periods, we know from the 1995 returns and thereon. We know it also from the testimony of
the— taxpayer bring a countervening expert into the BTA hearing?
No. Now, to be fair, their people within the company are, of course, knowledgeable of what terms mean. But they represented that the revenues, what our expert said is kind of a two-part thing. He said the receipts means revenues.
Okay, means receipts, profits.
Yeah, and revenues, and they agree with that. Their own witnesses agreed. The expert said receipts means revenues. Okay, they didn't have anything to counteract that, but they disagree with that. But they do agree that revenues means the gains or losses from the sales of the securities. That's their own witnesses admitted that, because that's how they disclose it on their financial statements. When they have revenues from the sale of stock on principal transactions, it's that net amount. It's that gain from the sale or loss. So they agree with that. They're just quarreling with the word receipts as connecting it to revenues. And that's where the cash flow statements that they file. Well, they repeat the receipts, and those receipts
In the more common understanding of receipts, I think we're attuned to thinking of receipts being gross receipts.
Right.
And in thinking of revenues, you do think of profits, that is, what's left.
In this industry, Your Honor, the gross revenues are the gains from the sale, gains or losses, the net gains or sales from the sale of the assets. That's for capital assets, that's what you refer to as gross revenues. Okay, so if it were some other kind of activity, yeah, you think of the full amount you get. But if you look in Black's Dictionary, for example, and you look under—
I don't think that's the place you would look to for an answer to a tax question.
Yeah, I understand, but I guess the big thing is this is broader than tax. This is financial statement disclosure. And as Mr. Bernert, I think, very correctly said, this is a balance sheet tax. It's based on the net worth, which, those are financial terms. So, to be sure, income tax is based on financial statements as well. But it's not, that income tax reference derives from the broader category of financial.
And basically, your argument is, and what the two of you are arguing about, is the precise meaning of these words in the context of essentially a property tax.
Yeah, a tax on the net worth of the company, right.
As opposed to what those words might mean in terms of an income tax.
That's right, Your Honor. But again, we're not relying on our expert witness did not testify about income taxes. He testified about how it's used on the financial statements and how it's used in the financial industries. And they, when you look at how they refer to revenues, gross revenues, they refer to, with respect to the sales of stock or other securities, they refer to it as the gains or losses. They don't keep track of the gross sales prices, the sales proceeds. That's not even something that they keep track of. And that's why I think it was very acceptable for them to think that way when they're filing their dealer intangibles tax return. They think in terms of the earnings that are generated.
You've used your time, Mr. Hubbard.
Oh, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Bernert, you've saved almost 2 minutes of your time.
Thank you, Your Honor. This case really comes down to gross receipts means gross receipts. It means it for the dealer and intangible tax, and it means that in the financial industry as well.
Counsel, let me interrupt you for a minute. It was mentioned that the general accounting practices is the guide here. Would you agree with that?
No, not for purposes of apportionment. It is for the base. In the franchise tax area, there are a number of cases where the court has declined to follow financial accounting for purposes of establishing the apportionment. And the reason for that is When I'm doing financial accounting, I'm worrying about capturing my income and my loss. I'm not worrying about assigning it to here and there. So in a number of cases that you have found that it isn't used for this purpose. But more fundamentally, Your Honor, the reason we didn't even mention Professor Stevens is that there was a question asked, what is gross receipts for financial accounting purposes? And on page 7 of our reply brief, and also we talked about it in our principal brief, so for financial accounting purposes, the term receipts isn't used at all. That's a question to Professor Stevens. Answer, it's not presented on the financial statement. So the reason we haven't talked about it is, I don't know that people were listening, but his testimony was, we don't use the term receipts or gross receipts for financial accounting purposes. And that's very significant. And that impeaches his testimony in the sense, not that he doesn't know what he's talking about, but that it isn't helping you decide this question. Which gets to the other point is, I can't imagine why the court would be relying on what an accountant says in this particular case, especially when you're considering it's a 1931 statute, and the only testimony was about financial reporting, that is, accounting for income in the current day. So it really just doesn't make any difference what Professor Stevens said. And there wasn't a longstanding interpretation, and the statute means what it says.
Did I understand you said there is not a longstanding interpretation of this statute?
Absolutely, Your Honor, there's not.
I thought Mr. Hubbard made the argument to us that this had been the practice for some 30 years of the method of calculation in determining what goes in the numerator and denominator of that equation.
Yes, he did say that.
And he's suggesting to us, if I understood his argument correctly, your position is changing what had been done for at least a generation.
Your Honor, absolutely disagree that it's changing that position. And what we have is that the
Are you suggesting that what you're proposing to us is the standard and is what is done commonly throughout this industry?
As far as I know, it absolutely is, yes. And from 1931 on, and we know that gross receipts was to be used for outright sales as of 1941. Now we're told going back from 1999 that there had been a statement accompanying the return that changed it. It changed from receipts to income.
Yes.
But a couple things, you can't change the statute, even the tax commissioner can't change the statute by instructions. Now what was represented to the board is that's probably the way it had looked in prior years. But what we were able to show is that the return had changed in 95, from 94 to 95. So it wasn't a longstanding. Then what do you have? You have nothing in writing anywhere. In other cases where you've looked at the question of whether there's a longstanding opinion, there's something in writing someplace. Even if there are agents in the tax department that if you had called them on the phone, they would have said, here's my position, you use net gains and losses, who cares? That can't be something that this court has to defer to, and it's not something the General Assembly could have known about because it's not disclosed. So we absolutely submit that there was not any longstanding interpretation contrary to what we're asking you to decide in this case.
Counsel, this happens occasionally. Maybe it happens more often in tax cases than other kinds of cases where counsel on both sides are representing the history as being something entirely different, and I'm not sure the record is going to help us a lot on that. There is something, however, that Mr. Hubbard said that I would assume is not factually in dispute, and that is that your client had been for back as far as, I don't know how far back he took it, but for a long period of time using the profits rather than the gross receipts in making this calculation for years going back beyond the audit years or the years in question here.
Yes, Your Honor, two parts. First of all, with respect to what do we do about these kinds of, we can't come together on what happened in the past. That's why you rely on what the task commissioner issues in writing. That's why this court has said if there's going to be a rule of general or a policy of general application promulgated as a rule, And then we don't have that problem. We're not saying, well, what did somebody say and what did somebody believe in the tax department? We know that going back to 1995, that Payne Weber, the predecessor, had used net gains, but it was wrong. It was wrong in 95 and it was wrong in 99 to 2001.
Thank you, Mr. Thank Brenner. Your Honor. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.